The date is November 18th, 1988.
And we're watching The Land Before Time.
Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Like and subscribe.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One. This is the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me is the Petrie to my ducky,
Paul Petrie,
Colin Stewart.
And this week, you may have noticed how our opening sounded a little different. Those were my youngest two children. They have been bugging me to listen to an episode of our podcast, so I promised them that I would do a profanity-free episode with a movie that they can actually watch. And so for this special profanity-free episode, we brought in a special guest, a young man who you will be hearing more from in this summer's Paw Patrol movie, a movie that features the voices of Dax Shepard, Randall Park, Ian Armitage, who is young Sheldon, Jimmy Kimmel, Kim Kardashian West, and our very special guest for today, our friend Will Brisbane. Will, welcome!
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, we're very excited. Yeah, we've got a man here, a young man, who, first of all, gets the honor of being our youngest guest so far.
Thank you.
But with Will, yes, he has recently been cast in the Paw Patrol movie, and so we did an animated movie so that we could maybe get some inside information about how it works now that Will has peeked behind the curtain, seen how the sausage gets made, all that sort of thing. Now that you have done voice work, do you look at an animated movie differently?
Honestly, I do. I used to, when I watch it, think nothing really of the voice actors. But now that I've experienced, you know, being in the booth and stuff, I have so much more respect for them because it's hard. Like, it's really hard just to, yeah, because you're sitting in there hours at a time trying to get the line perfect. And yeah, my first few times in the booth, I was, it was pretty tough for sure. I'm not going to lie.
Now, I do know that a movie like Road to El Dorado was kind of groundbreaking with the fact that they would have multiple people in the booth at the same time, and it was something that was very unusual. Now, when you are recording, I mean, you're especially got a challenge because you're recording during COVID.
Right.
But with it, do you have headphones that have other performances feeding things into you, or do you just have to go blank off the page?
It's actually blank off the page. Like, I'm on a Zoom call with the directors and stuff, and the director feeds the line as best as he can. But it would definitely help, you know, if there was other lines feeding through, but they can't do that because I don't even know who the other actors are playing, because it's secret information for sure.
That's crazy. I would have thought, I was kind of wondering, like, if it was like some massive, almost like Zoom call type situation where you all, like, I don't know, almost like a table read or something like that. But I feel that, kudos to you, that would be really hard to try to do a genuine performance just by reading a line.
In a way, it's kind of like working off of a green screen too. I mean, just same thing. You've just got no one there to play off of. But yeah, you mentioned that you don't even know who the other people are playing, because at this moment, it is a big secret who you are playing.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to say anything about that, but closer to the release date, probably like May, June, maybe even April, I'll be able to say, because it's closer to the release date, because they're releasing it as a promotional kind of lead up.
And I will assure the producers of the movie that Will is taking this very seriously, because I have seen people on his social medias that have been trying to get the information out of him. I have tried to get the information out of him because I have a niece that is absolutely obsessed with the show. My kids love the show. And I mean, I would love to get Will to record something for my niece in the voice of his character, but he's not allowed to tell me who his character is. But
maybe in the future.
I was going to ask you if you got to meet Dax Shepard, because I love his podcast, but I guess if you don't get to see him yet, no.
Right. No, maybe in the future. And yeah, his podcast is actually sick. Like, it's awesome. Yeah.
So, Will, if we wouldn't have been in COVID times, would you have got to go out to, like, Los Angeles to record it all or anything like that? Or
was it always Yeah. Like, Toronto and LA. Like, I went to Toronto for the audition and stuff, which was, yeah it was super awesome. Too bad I couldn't have gone again, you know, COVID.
Yeah.
Too bad, but making the most of a bad situation, I guess.
Yeah, it's still sweet to get the part. That'd be super exciting.
Yeah, it's been pretty awesome.
So have you seen, like, any of the preview of the animation with your voice in it?
I have seen bits, yeah.
Okay.
But, like, I don't have much to work off of.
Yeah. So now this week we are looking at The Land Before Time. So what kind of experience do you have with this particular movie, Will? Because you are significantly younger than this movie.
Right. Well, I grew up on, like, the little animated specials from more the 2000s to early 2010s era. Yeah, but I never really watched the first movie until maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I got it on DVD to watch on a plane, and I really enjoyed it. I was like, you know, the sequels, they were like any sequel, good but not great. But the first one just blew me away, especially given 1988. Like,
yeah. Well, so this week we are looking back at November 1988 when the movies in theaters were Child's Play, Moonwalker, I'm Gonna Get Ya, Sucker, Oliver and Company, so it's up against another animated movie, and of course, our movie for today, The Land Before Time, which earned $84.5 million on a $12.3 million budget.
Wow. And don't forget, there will be spoilers, so if you don't want this movie to be spoiled for you, please press pause, go watch it, and then come back. Please come back.
And make sure that you watch Land Before Time, because there are 14 of these Land Before Times movies. That blew my mind. The tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "The Adventure That Started It All." It's a pretty bold proclamation for a movie released in 1988. I mean, I get what they're going for, but still, "The Adventure That Started It All." But that, of course, may not be the best description of this movie. So let's go to Colin for a 60-second synopsis.
That's a really interesting tagline. Do you think when they made it, they knew there was going to be 14 movies? that tagline almost seems retroactive. Anyways. All right. A long time ago, when giants walked the earth, it was the age of the dinosaurs. After the death of his mother and an earthquake that separates him from his grandparents, a brontosaurus, I was just reading, and it's not a brontosaurus, I was wrong, it's an apatosaurus, for any paleontologists who might want to fight me. An apatosaurus named Littlefoot must join forces with a group of young dinosaurs from diverse backgrounds. Together, they learn the joys of teamwork and form new friendships while outrunning a dangerous sharp tooth on their way to the Great Valley, where they hope to be reunited with their families.
Right on. So, we did hear that Will is familiar with this movie. Colin, this was actually one that you requested for us to do as an animated movie, because you loved this movie as a child, or what's your experience with The Land Before Time?
Yeah, so Land Before Time is, it's the first, I don't know if it's the first animated movie I ever watched, but it's the first one that I definitely remember.
Yeah.
And it was one of the, again, another movie, because back in the day, I didn't have cable or satellite TV, so all I had was movies on loop, and Land Before Time, from probably the ages of, I'm going to say 3 to 5, was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember really loving it as a kid, and I think I did watch a few of the sequels. I think I topped out at around 5.
Okay.
And I mean, I actually liked the sequels quite a bit, especially the second one, because that's when they have, like, the baby T-Rex or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the sequels, I will say, are very different from the original movie. They're all more musical in nature and that kind of thing. So I haven't watched the original in a long time. It was interesting to go back and watch it and realize that it actually takes itself pretty seriously.
Yeah.
For a kid's movie. And yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I know my littlest sister is only about 3 years younger than you. And she was one that was absolutely obsessed with these movies as well. So it must just be something about, you know, your generation, which is slightly younger than mine, and just being into this movie. She had the sing-alongs and all that sort of thing, too. Let's jump into The Land Before Time. It's directed by Don Bluth, who is an animation director with a pretty distinct style. He brought us movies like The Secret of Nim, An American Tale, All Dogs Go to Heaven, which, fun fact, was the first movie that ever made me cry.
Wow.
Rockadoodle, Thumbelina, I know. I was young. Anastasia, Bartok the Magnificent, and Titan A.E., which I think is an amazing film. Plus, also, if you spent time in arcades in the 80s, he was behind the Laserdisc arcade classics Dragon's Lair and Space Ace. It's produced by the dream team of Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Frank Marshall, and Kathleen Kennedy. And like in our Goonies episode, I don't think I really need to get into any of their credits. Written by Stu Krieger, who has written movies like the R-rated Where the Boys Are, Monkey Trouble, In the Army Now, which is a Pauly Shore classic, and then went into the genre of Disney Channel exclusives like Cowbells and the Xenon trilogy, which has Xenon the Zequel and Z3. Gotta kick it up and go into the mat. I don't have any idea what any of those movies are. It's also written by Judy Freudberg, who is a big-time Sesame Street writer, including one of my childhood favorites, Follow That Bird, An American Tale, and she gets the characters credits on all 14 Land Before Time movies, and also Tony Geis, who has a nearly identical credit list, plus a few single episodes of TV shows and the comedy special Cause, the Bill Cosby comedy special from 1975. We open on quite a slow burn of an opening, I'll say, where we're watching underwater bubbles slowly rising and the odd underwater creature swimming by. And we watch as one fish-like creature gets eaten by another one just to be chased and almost eaten by a bigger one. And I'm reminded of Qui-Gon Jinn and the Phantom Menace saying, "There's always a bigger fish." But then the illusion of the enormity of these fish is shattered when we see giant dinosaur feet tramping through the water. And then the narration kicks in about long before humans roamed the earth, pretty much the first 10 seconds of Colin's 60-second synopsis there. So yada, 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 basically running down a list of various mammals that don't exist yet. I don't understand why this list of mammals is so detailed. It's like, before the armadillo, before the monkey, before the whatever it was.
I guess maybe they were just trying to, like, I'm just thinking it's like somebody's like just thinking of like what are some animals that never get enough credit. We're just gonna list them all off right now.
So the narrator is voiced by Pat Hingle, who has 200 credits back to On the Waterfront in 1954, Hang 'Em High, Brewster's Millions, Talladega Nights, Baby Boom, Maximum Overdrive, but frankly, I know him best as Commissioner Gordon in the Tim Burton, Joel Schumacher, Batman movies, and he's got no other animation credits. His narration drones on in a bit of an educational way. It was the time of dinosaurs, the leaves were disappearing, the only green food was in the Great Valley. I'm just wondering, like, why would these dinosaurs spend so much time watching their stores of food be depleted instead of seeking the Great Valley earlier?
Yeah, that's a pretty good point. I was thinking the same thing when I was watching. The only thought I could have came up with is that none of them knew the Great Valley existed until it was too late, and then, you know.
Oh, it's kind of like Krypton blowing up in the Superman story. When there's only enough time to rescue one baby.
I don't even know where I get this from, but I was always under the understanding that the Great Valley was like the earth used to be more like green everywhere, and like the tribes would roam. So the Great Valley was like, it would be like, say you live in Peace River, but you know, Edmonton's that great shining star to the south or whatever. And so it's like, now the world is all gone to hell, but we know if we can just get over there, then we'll survive. But
yeah. So we start seeing dinosaur eggs hatching. First Ducky, who is born to swim, and then Sarah, who we see is immediately aggressive and fearless by headbutting everything around her. And finally, we see a single unattended egg, which gets snatched up by a scavenger dinosaur. But the theft is short-lived when the scavenger gets swatted out of the way by Mama's tail. Egg saved from consumption. So the narrator tells us that this is the only egg from their herd, the herd of longnecks, which now that the egg is hatching, becomes a herd of four. Because only Mother, who is played by Helen Shaver, who was in Amityville Horror, The Color of Money, The Craft, Tremors 2, and 87 episodes of The Poltergeist Legacy. She has no other animation credits as well. Grandfather, who is played by Bill Irwin. His credits go back to 1941. He has 244 credits. But we mentioned in our Home Alone episode is appearing in that and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and she's having a baby. And Grandmother, who must not have any lines, because there is no actress listed as grandmother. But then the funny thing is, I read that Bill Irwin is credited as grandfather, but his character never actually says anything. And I did not notice that on my watch of this movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't remember the grandparents talking at all.
Yeah. I could have sworn they said something like at the very end, like in the Great Valley.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, I just...
or two lines.
Did either of you read that? When they were originally envisioning this movie, they wanted it to be completely voiceless. Like, no, like the animals wouldn't talk at all.
I read that, yes.
I feel like that would have been a way different movie.
Yeah. And there were like 19 minutes cut out of this movie that might have made it flow a little bit better. But I guess the 19 minutes that were cut out, leaving this at a blistering hour and 8 minutes. But I guess most of them had to do with Sharptooth, and they decided was too intense.
So having watched this movie when I was really young, every time the Sharptooth, the Tyrannosaurus, comes on screen, I do remember feeling like it was really scary.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine there being scarier things that they cut out. Or just the thing I read was like they didn't want to have seen like a lot of scenes that showed that the kids in peril, but that's mostly what I remember about this movie.
Yeah. And after watching it again and refreshing myself, that's definitely the repeating story in this movie, is the kids separating and then the kids getting in peril and then the kids getting back together. Like, that happens, what, like 3-4 times in this movie?
Yeah. Easily.
But because of what a big deal it is that these long necks have only one egg, it becomes a spectacle with other creatures gathering around to watch the birth, like the Lion King.
I mean, I'm pretty sure they even use the word circle of life, so it,
they it is do, very much yes. The Lion King. Yes. Littlefoot is born, and he is played by Gabriel Damon, who has 46 credits, 23 episodes of a show called Call of Glory, which ran from 84 to 85, 25 episodes of a show called One Big Family, which ran from 86 to 87. He was in Newsies, RoboCop 2, and he has other animation voice work. He was in Pound Puppies and a Superman series from 1988. Little Nemo, not Finding Nemo, Little Nemo in 1989, where he played the title character. And he was in Tailspin. We see in Littlefoot's introduction that he is far more timid and skittish, like almost the complete opposite than Sarah was in her introduction. I do love watching Littlefoot curl up in his mom's back fat, though. I thought there's something adorable about that.
Did you guys think it was weird that, you know, she swats that egg stealer away and that was like to save him, but he still manages to fall through all that stuff and all that water and not be imperiled in any way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The family heads out on their quest to find the Great Valley because there's no green food left. It's going to be a long journey. The bright circle must pass over them many times as they head towards where it touches the ground. They'll go past the rock that looks like a long neck and over the fire mountains. I have to admit, I appreciate the language that they use in this movie instead of just spoon-feeding us with the words that we'd use. Like, you even brought up Brontosaurus in your 60-second synopsis. I mean, it doesn't really matter because they're just long necks anyway. You know, three horns, sharp tooth, you know, and also the fact that they use words like earth shake instead of earthquake. I find it fun that they've kind of made up this language that's more descriptive, maybe, than the words that we would use.
Yeah.
My thing with that is it's really great, but it just lacked consistency in a few parts. Like, the one part that immediately comes to mind is when the mother first gives Littlefoot like the tree star.
Yeah.
And then immediately after calling it a tree star, she calls it a leaf. I was like, well.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
The one thing I really appreciate, I like that this movie is a primer for kids who love dinosaurs. Because I don't know if it's still like this, but when I was younger, I feel like every kid went through a stage where they were completely fascinated with dinosaurs for probably like 6 months to a year. And this movie was perfectly, there was like The Land Before Time, and then 5 years later, Jurassic Park came out. So my dinosaur love fire was stoked for so long, for like probably 10 years.
Because you got to grow into Jurassic Park as well, because you know, you were a little kid when this was out, or when whatever the first five were out, and then by the time Jurassic Park comes out, you're age appropriate.
Like I remember in Jurassic Park, the first time, I think the very first dinosaur you see is a Brontosaurus or something like that, like and I remember thinking like, oh, like it's a long neck.
So, as they make their hero's journey across the land, which, like Lord of the Rings or Willow, just involves a whole bunch of walking, Littlefoot encounters Sarah, who is busy trying to catch a bug, and this is played by 8-year-old Candace Hudson, who has 19 credits. She was in 74 episodes of Evening Shade, Full House, Baywatch, Married with Children, and reprises Sarah in Land Before Time 2, 3, and 4. She's one of the only actresses that did reprise the role for any of the future movies. So this is something that you're probably very familiar with, though, like the fact that this is an 8-year-old that's doing this role. So for Will, I mean, you understand that with something like Paw Patrol, you know, you're kind of... You gotta go now while you've still got the voice for it, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's always the big fear that, you know, you'll lose the voice. Yeah, I've had nightmares about that, where like one last recording session, and then they're like, "Yeah, sorry, your voice kind of got deep. You're out of the movie."
I know that just by following you on your Instagram that you recently had to go in for a re-recording session to pick up some new stuff. So what would they have done if your voice had, you know, if you had suddenly hit a major growth spurt between your first recording and this new one?
Right. Well, I don't think if I had lost my voice earlier in the process, it would have been awful. I would have gotten cut from the movie. But if I had lost it like last Tuesday, nothing would have really changed, because it's mostly just pickups and trying to perfect it. But like, they would have enough perfect takes, and even if they weren't perfect, like great takes to run with, they just wouldn't get the perfection aspect of it.
Yeah.
Mm. I never would have thought of that. That would give me nightmares if I was in your situation too. The last thing you want to be is come back and they're like, oh, like, so we're recording today, and you're like, oh, I'm okay, like, just super deep.
Yeah, something's happened in the last 3 months, guys. So Littlefoot finds Sarah amusing and is trying to initiate a bit of a playmate relationship with her. They line up to charge at each other for a little headbutt jousting. And man, if I had a nickel for every time someone wanted to play that game as a child with me. And as they're running towards each other, Sarah's dad puts his foot down to block Sarah. And this is Daddy Tops, voiced by Burke Burns, who has 81 credits. He was in Airplane 2, Air America, Curly Sue, Child's Play 3, and Fun with Dick and Jane, which is the 1977 version. I did not know that the Jim Carrey version was a remake.
Huh. I didn't know that either, actually.
But Burke Burns also has no other animation credits. It turns out that Daddy Tops is kind of a racist, and we get an important lesson about how a child's environment impacts the person that they become, because as the movie goes on, we see that Sarah is almost as much of a racist. His big lesson of three horns don't play with long necks gets reiterated several times as the movie progresses. And Mom Longneck's reaction is that of like a marginalized individual when she explains to Littlefoot that we keep to our own kind because we're different. So I don't know whether this was a good lesson to be teaching people, because it really is a bit of a disguised racism situation going on here, or I guess not even that well disguised.
Yeah, it was pretty openly racist. Yeah.
That's an element of this movie that I do not, well, not, I shouldn't say I don't remember it. I never picked up on it as a kid.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
When I was watching this movie back, I was like, oh, how interesting, how progressive for the times.
So we've got more walking around for the family and Littlefoot getting a chance to explore the world. His curiosity gets him to follow a frog, for example. But this is something that I've always wondered in cartoons. Like, in this case, why can a dinosaur talk, but a frog can't? It's like the dogs versus, to use a perfect example, a dogs versus the cats in Paw Patrol. The catastrophe crew cannot talk.
Exactly.
But the pups all can.
Yeah, and no other animal in the show can talk either.
Yeah, Chicoletta can't talk, all that sort of stuff, but Colin, whose kid isn't quite at Paw Patrol age, so he doesn't quite follow these references.
No.
It's like Goofy and Pluto. Like, they're both dogs. Why is one of them a pet? I've always wondered that in animated movies.
Yeah, Pluto probably is, like, just sitting in his doghouse and looking at Goofy, and he's like, man, this is pretty degrading.
Yeah, or he's just saying that just because I choose not to talk doesn't mean that I can't talk. So while chasing the frog, Littlefoot comes across Sarah again. She has been brainwashed by her racist father and refuses to have anything to do with him. But as they're both separated from their parents, a shadow moves in and they are being stalked by Sharptooth. By Sharptooth, who is voiced, in quotation marks, by an uncredited Frank Welker. Like, here's even another example. Sharptooth can't talk, but all the other dinosaurs can.
I mean, I feel like if Sharptooth talks, then this movie becomes a horror movie, because it's just literally like The Shining.
Yeah.
But Frank Welker also in this movie does the sounds for Spike, because Spike is another one that doesn't talk. But I think it's just because he hasn't learned to talk yet. And the Domeheads gang. I've mentioned Frank Welker before in our Mortal Kombat episode, number six, if you want to go back and hear that, where he basically just did sounds for Reptile, kind of like he just does sounds here, because he does a lot of sounds. But if you don't know who Frank Welker is, he voices Fred in Scooby-Doo, Optimus Prime, Nibbler on Futurama, Garfield in the newer Garfield series. But for Mortal Kombat, I never actually did the research on him. I looked him up on IMDb, and he has 859 credits.
There you go, Will. Something to aspire to.
Like, I thought
it must be like 100 pages. Like, you could, that's like a novel.
Because a lot of what he does is he'll come in and he'll do some squeaks for people. You know, because he does these amazing sound effects. But, like, I thought Danny Trejo had a lot at 400. Like, he has nothing on Frank Welker.
I feel like though, that has to be fairly common for, like, voice actors. Like, I have to imagine, like, John DiMaggio must have a ton. I know, like, what's the guy from Pinky and the Brain? Maurice LaMarche. I think he has a ton. Billy West has a ton.
Yeah, because yeah.
Well, because, like, animation, they can just, like, pump out movies because there's no location or anything like that. Like, yeah, so it's just really easy.
Well, and you don't have to worry about them getting older. I mean, everyone from The Simpsons has got to be in their 60s by now.
Oh, yeah.
I once listened to a podcast that was talking about the guy who voiced George Jetson, and he voiced every incarnation of George Jetson, I think, until he died in like 2012 or something.
Well, yeah, Frank Welker is still doing Freddy, and that's been 40 years of that character.
Yeah, he was Fred in the new Scoob movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Sarah and Littlefoot see Sharptooth, and they run for their lives, temporarily losing him in some thorny brambles. And as they're working to evade him, they come out the other end of these thorns and almost get got until bum-ba-da-ba, Mama Longneck to the rescue. And she swats Sharptooth out of the way with her tail, and then a fight breaks out. Mama is battling to protect the kids, tells them to run while she holds him off. But just when things are looking bleak, they get even bleaker because an earthshake starts and the ground starts splitting open. And the narrator is nice enough to explain that this is because of continental shifts. It seems like an awful fast thing to be happening. Like, I would be under the impression that these continental shifts are running around out there like bumper boats or something with the amount of violence that happens right in this moment.
It's like Tremors.
So there's all sorts of high stakes moments happening, like Littlefoot almost falling off a cliff into the waiting jaws of Sharptooth, and the fight going on. And when all the dust has settled, Sharptooth is at the bottom of a chasm. Sarah is separated from her parents by a big divide, and Littlefoot's mother is dying, just like Bambi's mother or Mufasa in The Lion King. I have a few Lion King parallels that I've found in this movie, so just thought I'd mention that I will be bringing up The Lion King again.
I kind of felt like, I don't know about you, I didn't feel like she took that much damage to warrant death.
Yeah, that's true. Like, the only visible damage she really took was, like, when Sharptooth jumped on her back, because he kind of left, like, a hole. Like, yeah, there was definitely damage dealt. Yeah.
I was thinking, like, maybe her, the only thing I could think would be spinal damage, but when Littlefoot is egging her on, she's able to stand up. And I mean, yeah. I get it's a kids movie, so they're not going to show blood loss, but I also don't really feel like dinosaurs, from everything, I've never met one, but from everything I've ever been led to believe, they're pretty durable, like, tough hided creatures.
I mean, maybe all the real fatal injuries happened off screen while this other stuff was going on. But I suppose you can't really show her bleeding out.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess I just think that, like, everything that I've ever known about dinosaurs has led me to believe that, you know, they've got tough hides. I get it's a sharp tooth, that it's in the name, teeth are sharp, but still, like,
no, but like, especially a big species, for sure.
Yeah, with necks that long, you'd think that they have some sort of extra thick hide as a defense mechanism.
Right. Yeah. But in Jurassic World, in like 2014, 15, whenever that movie came out, all the long-necked dinosaurs, they just get mowed down, and they all have, like, just, like, two or three claw marks in their side. And I was like, no.
I don't know why, but to go back to the whole long-foot or long-neck tribe, for some reason on this go-around, it bothers me that they don't explain
where dad is.
Yeah. I don't remember for sure. I think it might come in later. I'm not sure that he's actually dead. I think he might appear in one of the sequels, like 13 or something like that. But
oh, they turn it into a real soap opera. They start bringing characters back from the dead.
Yeah.
So, yes, Mom succumbs to her injuries, but not before she has an opportunity to tell Littlefoot that he must continue on to the Great Valley and that she'll always be in his heart. But man, is this a depressing scene. Like, kids' animated movies just don't deal with death like this anymore. Like, I remember what a big deal Bambi's mom getting shot was when I was a kid, but, like, you just don't see this in movies anymore. Like, Up is one of the saddest Pixar movies there is in that beginning, and they kind of hint at the fact that the wife is dying, but you don't actually see her die.
Right, yeah. They don't, like, just take it head on.
Yeah. Well, she dies, and Littlefoot is now alone, having been separated from his grandparents in the earthshake. He's crying and aimlessly wandering around when he comes upon Rooter, who is also voiced by the narrator, Pat Hingle. Rooter consoles him a bit, but in a third Lion King parallel tells him that it is all part of the circle of life, and reiterates the last thing that Mom said about always being in his heart. Like, the fact that Mom has done all this, and then he goes on, like, this little depression walkabout of his, and then comes across this guy who just tells him exactly what Mom just finished saying. It's kind of like, why is this scene in there? Like, they cut out 19 minutes of Sharptooth.
I actually read that they put that scene in there to help children be able to, like, cope and understand death. So it was like...
Oh, okay. I guess, yeah, Littlefoot never does vocalize why he's sad, does he? He's never,
yeah,
never actually says, wait, wake up. Are you dead? Are you dead? Like,
yeah.
Well, and Dad was obviously gone before he hatched.
Yeah.
If Dad is dead.
Yeah, the article I read actually paralleled it with Bambi, where Bambi's mother dies off screen, and then it's kind of just like it just moves on, like they never really deal with it all that much. Yeah.
So being stuck in this depressing section of the movie, we now see a fun little scene of baby pterodactyl fighting over a single berry. The mom pterodactyl comes in and ends up giving every baby a berry to solve the problem. A cute little scene. And the last baby ends up bumping into the bummed out Littlefoot and offering up his berry to cheer him up. It's a sweet little moment.
I thought pterodactyls were carnivores.
Yeah, they definitely eat fish. I envision them kind of like eagles.
Yeah. No, because I was watching it and I was like, okay, that's interesting.
Huh, I didn't even think of that.
I definitely had to look it up because I was like, am I wrong?
Yeah, I definitely don't see them eating leaves. I can't think of a bird that just eats leaves. Most birds I know eat seed.
Insects and stuff and seed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Littlefoot is way beyond even noticing, though, because he's just so depressed. And so Littlefoot continues to aimlessly wander, so sad, when he comes upon a new tree star. And this triggers him to start imagining his mom's voice recapping everything she just told him in case we missed it the first time. But yeah, like you said about Bambi's mother, is it better to not address it? Or is it better to just dwell on it for so long like this movie does? Like, there's a good, like, 10-minute chunk of this movie where he's just in this depression.
You're so heartless.
So he then sees a shadow on the wall who he believes is his mother come back to life, and he runs towards it just to get a bit of a science lesson to learn that it's actually his shadow and that the farther away he gets from a light source, the smaller it gets. Oh, it's just so depressing.
I kind of thought that scene was stupid.
Yeah.
Because Littlefoot is clearly, there's clearly a gap in time between when he hatches from the egg to this point. He's significantly bigger. Like, he's significantly more grown. Mm-hmm. You're telling me he's never seen his own shadow? Come on!
Well, I guess, though, when you're that sad and just hoping that she's gonna come up behind you, you're gonna start seeing things. Or maybe he ate that berry and it was something that he shouldn't have eaten.
A hallucinogenic berry.
Finally, this large chunk of movie depression in the movie is finally broken up by Littlefoot once again finding Sarah. She is upset at being separated from her parents by the divide, so Littlefoot offers to team up with her. They could help each other, but Sarah, who is too proud and racist to accept, informs him that three horns don't need help from long necks. And there is definitely a lot of repetitive beats in this movie, and this is one of them. Offering to help Sarah, and then Sarah being too proud and refusing, and then they separate only to find each other again eventually.
Yeah, so, that's like one of the biggest plot points. It just comes back every time, even when they're the whole big group. Littlefoot goes one way. Or Sarah goes one way and it's the wrong way, yeah. And they have to work together, and then they go split apart again. It's confusing for sure.
So Littlefoot, who needed someone to just keep him company and take his mind off his crippling depression, is alone once more. And then we cut to Ducky, who is swimming around in some water. Ducky is played by 10-year-old Judith Barcy, who was in a bunch of TV movies and a bunch of TV episodes. She was always small for her age, so she was often cast as younger because she could convincingly play younger characters in shows like The Twilight Zone, Fall Guy, Remington Steele, Punky Brewster, Cagney and Lacey, Cheers. She made her feature film debut in Jaws the Revenge, but unfortunately this was like one of her last three movies because she was actually, her and her mom were murdered by her father. And then he killed himself. And so this movie was released posthumously. So this and All Dogs Go to Heaven, which she had already recorded for. So she is buried in the Hollywood Hills at Forest Lawn Memorial Park. And her tombstone actually reads, "Yup, yup, yup." That's what's on her tombstone. But Ducky, who has been swimming, finds Littlefoot sulking because his parents are gone and Sarah has rejected him. But Ducky is sickeningly optimistic, and she is a big mouth. And frankly, she's just one of my favorite characters in this movie. I love Ducky.
Yeah, honestly, in the first part where we kind of meet her, like, before she says anything, when she's first hatching, I thought that was just part of the credits, and I honestly forgot all about that until she came back. Yeah. But yeah, in my opinion, she is my favorite character. She just kind of brought so much more light. Because out of the depression stage.
She has a lot of good lines.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it's very good comic relief for sure.
Well, and I especially like her introduction here where Littlefoot is glumly telling her that they have to stick to their own kind and he can't hang out with her. But then she tries to tell him that she is a long neck by stretching out her neck and her tail as far as she can. Look, I'm a long neck. Like, she's definitely sweet and cheering him up with her yup, yup, yups.
Yeah, Ducky ends up being kind of the glue of the group.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is, the group doesn't really form without her because she kind of like is able to. Like, Littlefoot and Sarah are never going to get along. And then, you know, she's kind of like Petrie's mentor and encourager. And then obviously, like, she's just Spike's caretaker.
Ducky joins Littlefoot on her quest anyway, despite his grumpiness. And they come to a tree that still has a couple of leaves on it, but it's a talking tree. To which Ducky tells Littlefoot, "You should not eat talking trees. Nope, nope, nope." But it turns out that it's not actually a talking tree, but instead Petrie, who is voiced by Will Ryan, the only non-kid voicing these kid dinos. He was 48. But just like Frank Welker, Will Ryan is a career voice artist with 96 credits. Notably, he was in G.I. Joe and Smurfs. He has played Rabbit in Winnie the Pooh. He played Willy the Giant in, like, Mickey Mouse stuff, some of the newer Mickey Mouse stuff, and the Seahorse in Little Mermaid, plus other Don Bluth movies in American Tail, Thumbelina, and Rockadoodle. Petrie is definitely my second favorite character, I'd have to say. That's kind of why, in the opening, I called Colin my Petrie to my Ducky, because, you know, Littlefoot is just dull. And Spike doesn't say anything, so
I like Spike. He'd be a better character if he had more depth to him, but
and Sarah's just a straight up jerk. Like,
yeah, I hate Sarah.
So yeah, he's the flyer who can't fly, and his introduction where he falls out of the tree and asks, "I flied? No, you falled. How'd you get up there if you can't fly? I climbed." But they like Petrie, so he becomes the guardian of Littlefoot's tree star. And like you had called Ducky the glue of the group, Petrie is kind of, no pun intended, the flighty guy of the group. Like, he's just kind of there and he's fun, but not very smart.
Petrie is the character to me that has the most visible story arc. Like, he's the one who actually, like, gets through a problem. Sarah kind of, like, learns to be a friend, but she's still kind of a jerk the whole way through. Littlefoot, he's just kind of Littlefoot the whole way through. And, I mean, the rest, like, Spike doesn't talk. Ducky, again, she's, like, really funny and spunky, but her character doesn't really change from the time you meet her. Petrie's, like, really the only one who kind of, like, changes from being this flighty, scared guy to someone with courage.
Yeah, well, I think, like, some of the reasons why some of the characters don't change is just because, like, lack of problems or storylines. Like, Ducky doesn't have any problems, like, throughout the movie. But, yeah.
Well, because she is so optimistic.
Yeah, exactly.
He'll keep Littlefoot's tree star, the treasure, safe, and they head off on their quest. Petrie riding on Littlefoot's head, and Littlefoot informs him, "I'm not a carrier, you're a flyer, now fly!" Sarah, meanwhile, has stubbornly set out on her own and has stumbled across Sharptooth's body, and she acts tough by doing her ramming headbutts on him and to get out some aggression, and she backs up to get a big running start, and as she charges, his eye opens. Oh no, Sharptooth isn't dead after all. And with what you were saying earlier about how scary Sharptooth does appear at times, this is definitely one of those moments where I remember this one from when I was younger, and it's like, yeah, this is one of Sharptooth's really scary moments, is when that eye opens as she's charging towards him. So Sarah flees for her life. She ends up once again finding Littlefoot, and she tells him in a very Hermione Granger way, "I chose to come back to you." She tells her tale of her encounter with Sharptooth, and of course, it's not accurate to how we just witnessed it happening. It's so braggy. Everyone is in awe of her story except Littlefoot, who doesn't believe her at all because he saw Sharptooth fall into the hole. And she's also a bit of a bully because while she's roughhousing in her telling of the story, she ends up catapulting Ducky and launching her out of sight. And then where Ducky lands, she finds an egg. She knocks on it and announces, "You're late, come out." And the egg hatches, and we round out our little mismatched group of heroes by the arrival of Spike, who eats all the grass around him and then falls asleep. But our journey needs to continue to find the Great Valley, so the squad heads out on their quest with Ducky riding Littlefoot's back while holding food to get Spike to follow, which I thought was hilarious. Littlefoot is smart and knows that apart from finding the valley, they should follow the water that they've found because the valley would need a bunch of water for all those trees. And so with this logic in place and following a stream, they find a clump of trees that they think is the valley. They comment that they expected it to be bigger, but it doesn't faze them. They found green food. So they start heading towards this green patch of trees when the ground starts shaking. Oh no, it's another earthshake. No, it's actually a bunch of fully grown dinosaurs who nearly trample the kids as they race to the trees and devour nearly all the leaves and race off before the kids can even get there. By the time they get to the clump, the adults have taken off, and all that's left are some leaves on the top of one of the shorter trees, but still a tree too tall for these kids to reach. So they ask Petrie, "Do you think you can fly up there?" And he says, "No." And Ducky says, "It's okay, Petrie. Lots of things can't fly. Rocks, trees, sticks, Spike."
That is my favorite line in the movie.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest.
That was a great one. So they make a body ladder to get to the leaves, with Sarah, of course, being too stubborn and refusing to help. She can get her own green food, she says. They manage
But they end up still giving her the food. So the thing I find weird, she didn't help, and then she just made fun of them. She was like, "You guys look ridiculous." And then still they all gave her her cut. And I was like, that's...
Well, no, they offered it to her, but she got her own. She headbutted the tree and knocked leaves to the ground.
Oh, I was pretty sure that Littlefoot brought it over and threw it on the ground, and she thought she had headbutted it.
Oh, maybe I turned away for a second there, but I thought that's what it was. So maybe I missed...
No, I don't know. Yeah, okay.
They manage to get the smallest and lightest of them, which is Petrie, into the tree, where we see that he's afraid of heights, but he manages to knock a bunch of leaves to the ground for everyone. Yeah, see, and I had here that they offered some to Sarah, but she ends up proving that she wasn't all talk and using a headbutt to the tree, so I wonder whether it was him that threw. But we're talking about green food, so I think I need to do a sponsorship corner!
How are you going to pull this one off?
I just don't want to be left out of the routine of having a sponsorship corner. So this week, The Land Before Time is brought to you by Green Food. And this has been Sponsorship Corner.
I thought for sure you were going to say Tree Stars, because they're the only like branded leaf in the valley.
So they need to camp for the night, but they are seriously freaked out by the fact that Sarah insists that Sharptooth is alive, and Littlefoot curls up in a footprint in the dirt to go to sleep. Sarah proclaims that she's not afraid of Sharptooths and goes to sleep somewhere else, and the rest of the gang decide to go curl up with Sarah because she seems tough and brave. But her uncomfortable sleeping place that she chose and the fact that she snores gets them to head over and curl up with Littlefoot instead, leaving Sarah alone and shivering. So she reluctantly wanders over and joins the rest of them too. In the morning, they wake up to the roar of Sharptooth. They run, and he chases after them, crushing Littlefoot's tree star. Nice guardian work, Petrie. They end up running through a little hole in a cliff and lose him. Phew, close call. And of course, even though she's been a jerk and doesn't really deserve it, she gets to have an I told you so moment here. So Sharptooth is still alive. She doesn't deserve being allowed to tell them I told you so, though.
Exactly.
The only reason Sarah does get to say I told you so is because in this situation, she woke up first and saw that the Sharptooth was there. And then she tried to wake up Littlefoot, and he was all like, yo, step off.
Oh, that's true.
Gives her a bit of sass. So, I mean, I'll give it to Sarah on this one.
So after this chase, they stumble across the rock that looks like a long neck. They're on the right track. Journey back on. The route gets a little bit more treacherous. They have to climb a mountain. And they get to the top thinking that they'll see the valley on the other side. And Sarah is furious because the valley isn't on the other side. But Littlefoot insists that they're going the right way because his mom said so. So Sarah calls Littlefoot's mom stupid and fisticuffs break out between them. Sarah leaves to go the easy way, quote unquote. Littlefoot is determined to continue his way, but the others decide to follow Sarah because easy is, you know, easier.
Man, I don't know why anybody would want to follow Sarah. She just keeps getting worse. She just blatantly made fun of Littlefoot's dead mom like 2 days ago. Like, man.
So Sarah's journey takes them through lava fields and tar pits. Not very easy, Sarah. They end up in perilous situations surrounded by lava and until finally ending up in tar pits where they are stuck and sinking. But it's Littlefoot to the rescue. But Sarah, meanwhile, has been separated again and is being chased by the hammerheads. And then there's a howling and a creature comes stumbling into the cave where Sarah and the hammerheads are. And the hammerheads are scared away by this new creature. And Sarah as well is cowering when the creature reveals itself to be the four others covered in tar. But of course Sarah says she knew it was them all along, just adding an extra level to how mean of a person Sarah is. But she's too proud to admit that she's gone the wrong way and continues on her way, while the rest decide, hey, maybe Littlefoot's idea was the best one. Maybe we'll go with Littlefoot. He seems to know what he's talking about. They are headed out again when Sharptooth reappears. But Littlefoot decides that they need to make a stand and kill Sharptooth. And so they make a plan that where they'll drop a boulder from a nearby cliff and then drown him in the deep part of a pond. This has just gotten very violent all of a sudden.
Yeah, this whole part of the movie. Yeah, oof. Watching it again, I was like, man, I forgot this part was in here. Yes.
When I was watching it, I was admiring like the subtle lessons that this movie puts in for children. In this case, it's like, we're going to push him into the dark water because that's where the water is deepest.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's an important lesson for a young child to learn.
That is true.
So that they don't drown.
And if you've got tiny front arms, which most kids would have, you're not going to be able to swim because that's why they know that this will work against him because of his tiny front arms. So they decide that they'll use Ducky as bait. And so the plan kicks off, Ducky luring in Sharptooth while others prepare to push the rock. Sharptooth is scrambling to get at them, and they can't quite push the rock because it's just too heavy, and Ducky is in peril. And now Petrie chooses this moment to learn how to fly, and his character arc, just like Colin said earlier, his character arc just builds here because now he learns to fly, and he's trying to split Sharptooth's attention away from Ducky. And the rock still isn't budging, but Sarah comes to the rescue. She comes running in with a charge and headbutts the boulder, putting it over the edge and crashing it into Sharptooth, sending him into the deep water. But he gets one last snap at Petrie, apparently, bringing him down with him. But, you know, actually, that's a very good point with what you said earlier, Will, about did they just throw the leaves on Sarah? Because much like this being Petrie's moment to fly, this is actually Sarah's moment for her headbutt to actually do something useful.
Right, yeah. So that's why I kind of thought it was like the buildup.
So I might have to go back and double check that scene just to see if that is what it is, because it's actually kind of funnier to think that they just threw leaves at her.
And then it's like, it adds to her character's like meanness that she took the credit for it too. Like, she's just sitting there gloating. And yeah.
Yeah.
Littlefoot doesn't have the heart to tell her.
Yeah, the way I remember it, they did toss her the leaf, but she thought, in typical Sarah fashion, she thinks it was her who did it.
Okay.
Right, yeah.
It's sad time again. Poor Petrie. So, with very little mourning, everybody turns to leave, but Petrie claws his way up to the top. You were gonna leave without Petrie? Aw, Petrie's so adorable. I remember wanting a Petrie. Pizza Hut had this tie-in with Land Before Time way back when it came out.
Really?
You could get like puppets for this movie.
Wow.
Yeah, and I remember wanting the Petrie puppet.
That's awesome. I had no idea that. Before my time.
A little bit, yeah.
That was the Land Before Will's time.
I think even the Land Before Time 14 might be before Will's time.
Right.
Littlefoot is now hearing the voice of his mom again and sees her in the clouds in one last Lion King parallel. And the wind picks up, blowing the clouds away. But Littlefoot chases after them as they fly through the tunnel and come out the other side. I don't understand why these clouds are behaving like smoke.
Yeah, that was weird. I didn't understand that.
Yeah, I never thought of that.
They definitely don't have the physics of clouds down here.
No, unless it was like the mom's ghost and she was leading him.
Yeah, well, which she must do, because it comes out on the other side and forms back into the shape of a long neck. And he has his chance to say goodbye, and the clouds disperse and the sun comes out shining down and revealing the great valley below. They've found it, and they did it together is what they say, even though, you know, kind of not really.
During the whole movie I was watching it and they were talking about the great beyond, and I was actually skeptical about whether or not there was going to be a great beyond. Like, there were some, like, pretty tough, like, scenes, like, sad and, like, scary scenes. And I was like, it's entirely possible that the great beyond could just be, like, made up. I completely forgot that they made it when I was watching it again. So the whole time I was like, yikes, this could take a turn.
But, you know, I love how, like, everybody is taking credit, and it's like, well, it was kind of Littlefoot that did most of the work, and then Sarah just spent a lot of time complaining and taking off on them, and everyone else was just along for the ride. I mean, Spike had to be lured by food. Ducky had to hold food to lure him to come.
Yeah, that was definitely probably the most wasted space of the movie. The whole Spike storyline didn't make sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
But everything in this valley is just so green. Everyone gets reunited with their families. And then for some reason, we get a couple minutes of flashback to show scenes from the movie, summing up everything that we just watched.
Even though it was less than an hour and 9 minutes ago.
Yeah. And but they put like a foggy, you know, filter on it to make it look like it's memories.
Yeah.
It's kind of reminded me of Short Circuit.
Yeah,
it's just like in case you only got here in the last 5 minutes and you're now wondering what all happened before. Here's a montage with some emotional music.
Yeah,
I was also gonna say, in a weird way, the Spike and Ducky storyline also reminded me of the Goonies with
Sloth and Chunk.
Sloth and Chunk, yeah.
So the narrator comes back to tell us that they grew up together and told generations the tale. And the end. That is The Land Before Time. Oh, now Colin, Will, on IMDb, it scored a 7.4 out of 10, and it had a Metascore of 66. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 70% on the tomato meter, and an audience rating of 79%. But Colin, those are just numbers. Like a running headbutt from Sarah, why don't you hit us with some reviews?
All right, so I discovered a new place to find reviews this week. So okay. I've deviated from Rotten Tomatoes, and I don't have any critics' reviews this week for this movie. But what I do have are reviews from the Google Play Store.
Okay.
So here we go. Kylie Anderson says, "Loved this as a kid. Very cute family movie. It might be a bit annoying to adults, though. I can't remember. It's been a while since I've seen. Worth a rental. On a side note, finding out that the kid who did the voice of Littlefoot, who was my favorite character, was the same kid who played the foul-mouthed villain on RoboCop 2 kind of ruined my childhood. Sad face." And, okay, Bryce Carmony says, "Don't let the ugly head of capitalism ruin this film for you. Ignore the greed-driven swarm of soccer mom-targeted sequels to this great movie that somehow defame the original story, which is Land Before Time. Sure, the franchise as a whole is terrible, but the supernova success of the original that triggered it all does deserve to be acknowledged as a great film."
That's a guy that got to the part 12 and went, "Why am I still watching this? But I can't stop."
And then Dragor Skywing, probably not a real name, says, "This movie is amazing. It has depth and emotions that you can see. Littlefoot goes through the stages of grief and comes out the other side with the help of his new family and his friends and grandparents. 5 stars all the way." Okay. This was a 1-star review from David Marino.
Uh-oh.
Who says, "I watched this when I was little. Not anymore now. I'm into Jurassic Park and Jurassic World, and both movies are better than The Land Before Time, and also boring." That's with the exact punctuation, which he could have used a few more commas.
Yeah, that would imply that he just said that he loves Jurassic Park and Jurassic World that were boring. Yeah.
David could use some grammar lessons and learn how to use a comma, possibly.
So could
And also, he's putting Land Before Time and Jurassic Park in the same sentence when they're completely different movies.
Yeah, very much. Well, I think that first girl could use a grammar lesson as well, though, with her "I seen it" or whatever.
Yeah. Okay, here's the last one from a user named Emerald Lane. "When I was younger, I loved watching this movie, and I still do. It's one of those movies that you can just sit down and drink hot cocoa or tea." Which, sure.
Okay.
Whatever suits your fancy.
Right on. So we have, kind of floating around the mid-70s on average here. So, Will, you're our special guest this week. Where does this movie fall for you?
So I do think it holds up from what it was as a kid for me. It's always been a fantastic movie, in my opinion. And just to watch it again, I caught some little things. But all in all, it didn't really matter because the heart and the story, and obviously the very nice voice acting, is in there. And yeah, I enjoyed it very much. I'd probably give it out of 10. Like a 7.9 to an 8.1, somewhere in there.
You're up there pretty high. Now, I mean, for you, what would you say is one of your favorite feature-length cartoons, other than the obvious answer of the forthcoming Paw Patrol the movie?
Exactly.
But what usually floats your boat, though, if you're going to sit around and watch an animated feature?
Yeah, I'm definitely always a Pixar guy.
Okay, who isn't?
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, obviously my favorite animated franchise is Cars, but it's definitely, I love animation, and yeah, this was always one of my favorites.
Yeah. Colin, where does it fall for you?
Yeah, so for me, this movie is one where nostalgia just holds it through.
Yeah.
I have to say, the first thing I thought as soon as I started watching was, like, I just really miss, cartoon animation. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not saying that I have anything against, like, computer-animated, Pixar stuff, but I really miss that old-school animation, because that's what all the movies from my childhood were like.
Yeah.
overall, I think the movie, it's pretty basic. I definitely, on watching it this time, when I was younger, all the sequels made sense, but it seems so clear watching this movie that it was just meant to be one movie. Mm-hmm. And then obviously because it was such a financial success, they kept it going, but
forever.
I really think that if they had just left it at one, I agree with whatever that Google user was who said that the rest of them tarnished this movie's legacy, but I'd still give it probably, I'd be with Will, like a high, like sevens to maybe an 8 out of 10.
Yeah. See, I don't know whether these days with animated movies, and I even look at, you know, I'm not even talking about the Pixar movies and all that sort of thing. Like, I can look at something like The Little Mermaid or The Lion King or Beauty and the Beast, where these movies, they're a little bit faster paced. Like, this one is a slow burn, mm-hmm. a very slow burn. And I don't know whether I like that about this movie or whether it annoyed me. Like, I'm just wondering whether I was waiting for the action to pick up a bit more. I was waiting for it to be a little less repetitive. I was waiting for a broader story that never really seemed to happen because it was a simple story. But I can still appreciate for it for what it was and what it brought to us. And, you know, it does kind of make me wonder what that version with the extra 19 minutes would have looked like. It just, you know.
Right.
Whether it would have connected some of the scenes a little bit better, because some of them felt like they were just kind of out of place or, you know, took a weird jump to get there.
Yeah.
We could have done with, like, more scenes that connected it, but I felt we like, I'm fine with the amount of sharp tooth we had. Mm-hmm. Like, it was almost for an hour and 9 minute movie. It was a lot. And another 19 minutes of that, yeah, I wouldn't want to sit through that because it would basically be the same thing.
Yeah, I think what would have added some depth to the movie would have been if at the point where Littlefoot and Sarah separate, if the group had actually separated among them, mm-hmm. but then you need one more character so that there's two to go with each. And then you kind of would have had like maybe 10 minutes where each group is on their own. And then cut out some of the stuff that came before that. Like the scene that I find so out of place is the one where they see that weird grouping of trees, and then all those other dinosaurs just come past them and eat them all. Like, I feel like you could have done without all that.
Yeah, that was strange.
Yeah, like they could have just come across one tree. I mean, there's even if you split them up, like you don't necessarily need the extra people. Like the extra person, like you said, because like Spike doesn't talk anyway, so Spike and one person can go one way, and it would have been interesting to see those different partnerings though. But I that is very much what I felt like was kind of missing for me, was more of this relationship. We spend 10 minutes looking at Littlefoot just sulking, mm-hmm. and understandably he went through a very traumatic moment. But yeah, I would have liked to have seen once the fivesome met up and became this little group, I would have liked to have seen more interaction with them as a group, because that's what felt like was missing, was the character development of these kids on this quest together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I probably wouldn't go high 70s. I personally would go low 70s, maybe high 60s. If I'm being completely honest, but I do still appreciate it for what it was. And very much like you said, there are definitely moments these days that sometimes I miss that hand-drawn animation look.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when was the last like real hand-drawn animation movie?
The last one that I can think of that was really popular was The Emperor's New Groove.
Oh, I love The Emperor's New Groove.
That was a good one for sure.
And The Emperor's New Groove was from around the time of Road to El Dorado and everything like that, too. I'm just trying to think. I remember there being one maybe 5 years ago, and it was such a big deal, but I can't for the life of me remember what it was. But it was such a big deal that it was this 2D animation style instead of computer animated. But
I don't know. It's crazy, even when you were going down, like, Don Bluth's credit listing, because yeah, like Secret of Nim, American Tail, Rockadoodle, I love that movie. Those are all movies I really remember when I, like, from growing up.
Maybe another thing that I felt like was missing from this was just kind of the musical aspect, because you get so used to animated movies having a musical side to them. And like with Don Bluth, this is one of his only ones that doesn't have some sort of musical aspect to it.
Yeah, it's like there wasn't even really a score.
No. And, you know, it's got the Diana Ross song at the end of it. But other than that, you know, Rockadoodle is a musical. All Dogs Go to Heaven has musical aspects. You know, like when it comes to Don Bluth, you mentioned one of them, Secret of Nim, and Titan A.E., I think, is the other one outside of this one that have absolutely no real music to them.
Yeah.
It definitely, a few musical numbers could have brought up that runtime for sure.
Write a couple songs. Hey, Colin, I asked Will what his go-to animation is. What about you?
Like, I grew up in the era of the 2D Disney movies, so I mean, those will always, like, hold a special place in my heart. Like, I love Hercules and Mulan specifically.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite animated movie, though, probably is Toy Story.
Okay.
If I really had to think about it. I love that movie so much.
Pixar is the bomb. I wanted to say another word there, but I did promise my kids profanity free.
Yeah.
So there we go. That is The Land Before Time, and that's our show for this week. A big thank you to our special guest for this week, Will Brisbane. Will, if people out there want to find you on the interwebs, if they want to get in on being a fan of yours before your movie drops, where can they find you online?
Right. Well, my Instagram is at Hollywood Willie, HollyWoodWilly. So if you want to go follow me on my Instagram, I post just awesome stuff from my life. It's pretty cool. Pretty awesome.
I can't wait to see when you get that little blue check mark. Then that's when you know you've made it.
That's a dream. That's a dream for sure.
And I mean, you know, this is not an official appearance for you for your Paw Patrol press circuit, but if people want to see Paw Patrol the movie, do you have any of those details? When does it come out?
Well, it'll be coming out August of 2021. Near the end of the month, so stay tuned for that, because it's pretty awesome. Yeah, I'm very lucky to be a part of it.
And who do you play?
Can't say.
Ah, come on, Will.
Tried to catch me off guard. I see what you did.
Thanks, Will.
Thank you. This was actually really awesome. I very much enjoyed myself.
Well, there we go. It's training for all those inevitable future interviews you're going to be dealing with.
Right.
Yeah, we'll ask. We want me to ask you some like press questions, like if you were a dog, what kind of dog would you want to be?
I honestly can't answer that question right now. Honestly, I don't know many dog types.
Well, it wouldn't be a Dalmatian because you're not playing Marshall according to IMDb. It wouldn't be a Bulldog because you're not playing Rubble according to IMDb. Yeah, you know, if Kimmel has you on his show and you want to tell the story about having to ask your agent for permission to do your friend's podcast, you know. I think that would be a great late night talk show story to tell. You know, and name drop us on Kimmel.
Right, yeah. I'll plug the show for sure.
If you ever get to have a one-on-one conversation with Dax Shepard, just tell him that I'm willing to be a guest anytime he needs. So.
That's right.
Right.
I don't really have anything interesting to talk about, but I'm pretty sure I could pull something up.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, get the guys from I used to like this one on Dax's show.
Yeah, that would be super fun.
If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to tell your friends, share our post. Word of mouth is the lifeblood of a podcast, trying to get noticed in the huge sea of shows out there. Or if you want to go above and beyond and to help us out on the business end, go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcast on and give us 5 stars. It doesn't really matter what you say. You could say, yep, yep, yep. It's those 5 stars that drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
And check out our website, www.podcast.com. iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all our episodes as well as all our social media. If you want to get in touch with us, send us an email, iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
And if you would like to be a producer of the show and donate to us, you can go to patreon.com/iusedtolikethisone and become part of our Patreon community. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter in the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.